This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Amistad is leaving many people wanting to learn more about the history of slavery. My guest Hugh Thomas is the author of the new book, The Slave Trade, The Story of the Atlantic Slave Trade from 1440 to 1870. His study focuses on the business of slavery and examines the slave merchants, men who often never saw slaves but profited from their sale. Thomas has been a history professor in England and head of the think tank, the Center for Policy Studies. When I spoke with him, he hadn't yet seen the film Amistad. However, Spielberg bought the film rights to Thomas's earlier book, Conquest, Cortez, Montezuma, and the Spanish Conquest of Mexico. The film Amistad begins with a rebellion on a slave ship. I asked you, Thomas, how common such rebellions were.
Well, I think that probably one out of every 10 slave voyage from Africa to the New World had some kind of rebellion. But most of them were put down very sharply and usually brutally. Most slave captains thought that there was always a danger of a rebellion while the slave ship was in sight of Africa, and the slaves might have thought that in certain circumstances they might even swim home. So the slaves were usually kept below decks until Africa had completely disappeared, but even so there were rebellions. The number of rebellions which were successful can be counted on the fingers of one hand, I think, really, because the trouble was that even if you were successful as a slave rebel and you got your fellow slaves successfully to kill all the Europeans who were forming the crew of the slave ship, then you didn't know what to do. You couldn't necessarily sail. You couldn't sail your ship back to Africa because you didn't know how to sail.
How significant do you find the rebellion on the Amistad in the history of slavery?
Well, I think it was a most unusual occasion in that the rebellion was successful. Of course, it was not a rebellion on a transatlantic shipment. It was a rebellion carried out in coastal waters off Cuba, and the rebels, of course, headed by Cinque, knew perfectly well that they had to have a trained sailor to sail, so they didn't kill him, and two Spaniards who were responsible for that sailing back to Africa, as the slaves supposed it was, were of course clever enough to sail their ship up so that it landed off, it anchored off Long Island. It was rather a brilliant achievement on their part, I must say.
What lens do you feel you're looking through in your book, The Slave Trade, or I guess to put it another way, what focus have you taken?
Well, I hope I've used a balanced lens, that's the right figure of speech, to give an impression of how the slave trade was founded, managed, and brought to an end. I haven't really sought to find villains. I think there are a lot of villains involved, but I have, I think, developed one or two heroes, who are chiefly the abolitionists, I suppose. On the other hand, those slaves who survived the journey and put pen to paper, like Equiano, is one of my heroes because he tells us what it was like to be a slave, and that's a very rare piece of documentation of great value. Perhaps I should have used him a little more. I don't know.
I'd like you to read a quote from an original source that your book begins with, and tell us who wrote what you're about to read and what the significance is.
Well, this passage was written by a Portuguese court historian called Gomes Yanes de Zurara, who was attached to the brother of the King of Portugal, Prince Henry the Navigator, who not only began the great Portuguese journeys down the west coast of Africa in the early 15th century, but also inspired the beginning of the slave trade, since originally he was looking for gold. He didn't find as much of that as he wanted, but instead he brought back men and women as slaves to Portugal.
And what is he describing here?
He's describing, Surara is describing, a shipment of slaves in 1444, about 230, who were brought back from what is now Mauritania to Portugal.
Would you read the quote to us?
Certainly. What heart could be so hard, this contemporary chronicler Zurara, a courtier attached to the brother of the King of Portugal, the inventive Prince Henry, asked himself, as not to be pierced with piteous feeling to see that company. For some kept their heads low and their faces bathed in tears, looking one upon another. Others stood groaning very dolorously, looking up to the height of heaven, fixing their eyes upon it, crying out loudly, as if asking help from the Father of Nature. Others struck their faces with the palms of their hands, throwing themselves at full length upon the ground, while others made lamentations in the manner of a dirge, after the custom of their country.
The quote that you just read was written in the mid-15th century by a Portuguese court chronicler. The Portuguese,
yes.
The Portuguese were the first Europeans to get involved in the African slave trade, and for a while the Portuguese were the biggest in the world of slave trade in Europe. Why were the Portuguese the first to get involved? Why did it start in the mid-15th century?
The Portuguese invented the whole business. They were the people who went down the west coast of Africa looking for gold, perhaps for spices, and actually also for gum, and then later ivory. But they brought back slaves continuously from the 1440s onwards, first of all to Europe, and then sold them to the Spaniards to take to the New World. And then they themselves took slaves to Brazil from the early 16th century. Why they were? Well, they were the most prominent maritime power in the Atlantic at that time. The Spaniards, the British, the French were all involved in their own civil wars in the mid-15th century. Portugal had the benefit of peace. They had curiosity. They had maritime skills. They used a great many Italian, principally Genoese, navigators and captains. And they had a maritime tradition based on fishing villages, which meant that a very high percentage of their population were concerned with the sea.
You say that the first technique that the Portuguese used for capturing Africans and taking them back as slaves was kidnapping. How did they do that?
Well, they simply arrived off an African port or settlement, sent boats from their ship to the shore, and perhaps at night raided the settlement and carried off as many Africans as they possibly could. That procedure really only lasted about 10 years, and by 1450, they were really negotiating their purchase of slaves by exchanging, bartering really, European goods for Africans. From the very beginning, textiles played a part, so did wine, so did metal bars, to begin with copper, then later on iron bars. The Portuguese didn't exchange weapons because they thought that was condemned by the church. It was illegal from the point of view of the church to carry or to exchange weapons with infidel peoples. Once they Christianized the people concerned, the weapons might be exchanged.
Now, you mentioned that the Portuguese started by kidnapping Africans and bringing them back as slaves, and then they started buying Africans from merchants in Africa. Who were the slave merchants in Africa at the height of the slave trade?
Well, there were kings like the King of Dahomey or the King of Ashanti. There were merchants of Muslim or other origin. There were also half-breeds, if that's not too offensive a word to use, people who were half African and half Portuguese or half English or half French. all the way along the coast of West Africa, there were these families of mulattoes who were pretty well established by the 18th century, which I think was the height of the slave trade, and they played a part as middlemen, serving as interpreters, informing the slave captains who came down the state of the market, so to speak, and they also procured slaves for these European colleagues. So this was something which was accepted as an institution. Slavery was accepted as an institution in Africa as it was by Europeans or by settlers in the Americas.
How did the merchants who sold the slaves to the European traders get the slaves?
Well, I think there were four different ways they might have obtained them. Firstly, they might have obtained them as prisoners of war in wars, which might have been no more than raids carried out specifically for the purpose of insuring slaves. Secondly, they might have kidnapped slaves, perhaps because of the desire to settle a debt, as I think happened at the beginning of the film Amistad, in relation to the slave Sinke. Then some African monarchies used punishment as a means of obtaining slaves. That's to say, if you committed a crime, that you might be enslaved. And there were occasions when families, out of poverty, sold their children, or sometimes even themselves, for slavery.
Were there any rebellions against the African merchants who sold fellow Africans into slavery?
Do you know, I don't think I can think of such an occasion, but there must have been one. Slaves certainly tried to escape their lot in one way or another by escaping. That's why they were usually chained one to another on the very often long walks from the African interior to the coast. But I actually can't remember a rebellion which was successful. The only occasion I think I can recall just at the moment is that when a number of so-called castle slaves in the then Dutch castle of Elmina in what is now Ghana realized that they were going to be transported across the Atlantic rather than kept in the castle serving the Dutch officials there, they took a step back and collectively committed suicide. They had secreted knives about their persons, and this was therefore possible.
My guest is Hugh Thomas, author of the new book, The Slave Trade. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Hugh Thomas, a British historian who has written a new book called The Slave Trade. Now, as horrible as conditions were in the places where slaves were held before being sent overseas, the conditions on the slave ships were abhorrent. You say about 12% of the Africans on the slave ships died before arriving in Europe. Would you describe one of the slave ships that you read about and what the conditions were like on that ship?
Well, the average slave ship, I suppose, was about no more than about 100 tons burden. The slaves were kept in a special deck, packed so far as the immediate stages were concerned, that to say, while the ship was in sight of Africa, like, as someone said, like spoons in a drawer, lying on their right side to avoid damage to the heart, as it was supposed, and they would be normally chained to each other. And the conditions there were filthy and disgraceful.
Louis Farrakhan has said that the Jews dominated the traffic in trades, that they were important in the slave trade. And I'm wondering what information you turned up in relation to that.
Well, I think that's an inaccurate statement, because Looking at the 18th century, for example, in relation to the United States and to Britain, that was the period when the British were chiefly involved and when they were beginning to carry, in fact, more slaves than anybody else, even more than the Portuguese. The numbers of slave traders or slave merchants in Britain who were Jewish seemed to me to be nil. As far as the United States was concerned, I think that there was one firm, that of Aaron Lopez and his in-laws in Newport, Rhode Island, who were of Portuguese-Jewish origin, but that was it. Newport was the biggest United States slave port, financing slave voyages, that is to say, and Lopez seems to me to be the only person who could be regarded as Jewish. Earlier on, it is fair to say that some converted Jews were dominant in the slave trade in the 16th century in Portugal and in Spain. But a converted Jew was, after all, someone who presented himself as a Christian. The Inquisition often denied that a converted Jew had really converted himself and often punished them because of secret Judaism. Mm-hmm. But this is so far as the 18th and the 19th century is concerned, this is complete myth, really. The slave trade went on until the 1860s, as far as Cuba was concerned, as far as Brazil was concerned, until the 1850s. I don't see any signs of any Jewish merchants involved at all. And it is in the 18th and the 19th centuries that most slaves were carried across the Atlantic.
What are your biggest questions about how slavery managed to last so long in the Americas?
The demand was greater from the non-North American, non-United States markets by far than it was in North America. That is to say, well over 90% of slaves carried across the Atlantic went to Brazil, the Spanish Empire, the British or French Caribbean, and only something less than 10%, perhaps only about a 6%, came to British North America or the successor state, the United States. The reason why it went on for so long was that there were always new possibilities. When, for example, the sugar plantations in Brazil began to decline, there was a demand for slaves in gold and diamond mines. When those began to be exhausted, there was a revival of sugar and then ultimately the development of coffee plantations. And it was thought always that slaves, black slaves from Africa, were the ideal workers in these places. And the same was true of the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, or the cacao or other plantations in Spanish America, or indeed even in the mines in Mexico. All those territories introduced vast numbers of slaves for different industrial or agricultural purposes, and they also had demand for slaves as domestic servants, who from the 16th or 17th centuries to the 19th, were used in every maritime town from Boston in the north to Buenos Aires in the south.
America has been so totally shaped by the institution of slavery. In your country, England, the British were very big in the slave trade, but they didn't bring Africans back to their own country to be used as slaves. So although the English were great participants in the slave trade, I think your country was shaped in a different way than America was. And I'm wondering if you think that slavery has remained much in the conscience of the British.
No, I think it has not. It would be a surprise to many English people living now to realize the extent to which their ancestors, or the ancestors of some of them anyway, were involved in such a iniquitous trade as the slave trade for so long up till the time of abolition. However, I think it's fair to say that the British did turn from supporting the slave trade so substantially into being the most prominent abolitionists. And the debate over abolition in England was extremely moving and interesting and, of course, in the end, successful.
Hugh Thomas is the author of the new book, The Slave Trade. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear what happened when the leader of the slave rebellion on the Amistad returned home to Sierra Leone. We'll talk to a historian and a playwright from Sierra Leone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.